Others have known me as Simon Peter, Simon, or Cephas. My name means rock. But if you were to ask my friends, they would probably tell you that it means one who talks before thinking. One day, while we were fishing on the Sea of Galilee, a man named Jesus was walking along on the shore. He called out and said he would make us fishers of men if we would just follow him. I had no idea what he was talking about, but there was something about him that made it impossible to ignore him. After we'd been with Jesus for some time, he gave us authority to cast out demons and to cure the sick boy. Boy, I cannot tell you how powerful that made me feel. Another time, Jesus sent us out in a boat ahead of him. In the middle of the night, a large windstorm caused us to think we were going to drown. Suddenly, we saw someone, or something, walking on the water. I was so scared. But a figure called out and said, "Do not be afraid." It was Jesus. I am a "you gotta prove it to me" type of guy. So I called out, "If it's really you, Lord, command me to walk out on the water to you." "Come," he said. I got out of that boat and I just started walking on that water towards him, and everything was great until I took my eyes off Jesus and let the noise of the wind and the crashing of the waves get my attention, and I began to sink. I knew I was going to drown, and just as I was going under, I was grabbed by someone's hand. It was Jesus. He whispered to me so that none of the others could hear, "Oh, you of little faith, why do you doubt?" One day while we were walking past Caesarea Philippi, Jesus asked the strangest question, "Who do people think I am?" Some of the guys said that he was a great prophet like Moses or Elijah, or maybe John the Baptist returning to life. Then he asked the question again. Only this time he said, "Who do you think I am?" And something came over me and I yelled, "You are the Messiah, the Son of the living God." And Jesus praised me and said, "Blessed are you, Simon, son of Jonah, for flesh and blood did not reveal that to you, but my Father who is in heaven." He then said, "You are Peter, and on this rock of belief, I will build my church, and the gates of hell will not prevail against it. I will give you the keys to the kingdom of heaven." Well, my head began to swell with pride. I was not paying all that much attention to what Jesus was saying until I heard him say something about he had to go to Jerusalem to be tortured at the hands of the elders and the chief priests and the scribes. He said that would lead to his being killed, but on the third day he would raise. What was he saying? It did not make sense. The Messiah was not supposed to be tortured and killed. The Messiah was supposed to rescue us from our oppressors. I grabbed Jesus and started yelling at him, "God forbid it, Lord. Never will it happen to you." Then it happened. Jesus turned and looked directly at me. And in an angry voice, he said, "Get behind me, Satan. You are a stumbling block to me because you're setting your mind not on divine things, but on human things." Wow. In just a short period of time, I had gone from being the rock of the church to being called Satan. I thought, what in the world is going on? He then began to tell us that we all have a cross to bear. He told us that we were to pick it up and to follow him, because those who try to save their lives in this world will lose it in the next. and those who lose their lives in this world for Jesus' sake will gain it in the next. We spent 3 years with Jesus as we learned from him. He taught us about forgiveness, leaving everything to follow him. He showed us how in serving those in need, we were actually taking care of him. I learned so much from him. I thought I had changed. But soon, I was to learn that I was that same old Peter. I cannot believe how much change can happen in 5 days. Last Sunday, Jesus rode into Jerusalem on a donkey. First, we heard the noise of the crowd, the cheering, the shouting. And as we drew nearer, we could hear what was being said. The king is coming. The king is coming. The king is coming. And more curious than ever, they pressed forward to see what was happening. Some people were tearing off their coats and throwing them in the road. Others were scrambling up trees and breaking off branches, throwing them in the floor and road before him. The children lined the city streets, waving their victory branches and singing, "Hosanna, blessed is the King who comes in the name of the Lord. Hosanna in the highest, in the name of the Lord." Then they saw the king himself, a man riding on a donkey, the symbol of royal authority, coming in peace. Grabbing the nearest elbow, they pointed to the gentle rider and demanded, "Who is this?" The crowds answered, "This is Jesus." And that's what happened on that first Palm Sunday, the day Jesus rode into Jerusalem, gentle and riding on a donkey. But something else happened that day as well. While Jesus was making his triumphant entry, the priests were praising God at the temple. It was the first day of the week, and according to the ancient rabbis, the priests were reciting Psalms 24, verses 7 through 10.
"Lift up your heads, O gates, be lifted up, you ancient doors, that the King of glory may come in. Who is this King of glory? The Lord strong and mighty, the Lord mighty in battle. Lift up your heads, O gates, lift them up, you ancient doors, and the King of, that the King of glory may come in. Who is
the people in the streets and the priests at the temples were asking the same question. Who is this king? The people said it was Jesus. The priests said it was the Lord. The weekdays went by so fast as Jesus continued to teach us. Then it was Thursday evening. We had gathered in the upper room to celebrate the Passover feast with Jesus. As we were sitting around the table, he told us that one of us in the room would betray him. We could not believe it. We began to talk among ourselves, trying to figure out who could it be. Then Jesus took the unleavened bread, and he broke it, blessed it, and he gave it to us, saying, "Take, eat, this is my body." And then he took the cup, gave thanks, and gave it to us, saying, "Drink from it, all of you. This is my blood of the new covenant, which is poured out for many for the forgiveness of sins. I tell you that I will not eat from this fruit of the vine from now until the day I drink it new with you in my Father's kingdom." We sang a hymn and went out to the Mount of Olives. When we were in the garden, Jesus told us that we would all desert him. Of course, I quickly told him that if everyone else left him, I would never leave. Jesus turned to look directly at me. He had great sadness in his eyes as he told me that before the rooster crowed in the morning, I would deny knowing him 3 times. I was shocked. I was mortified. I swore back at him that even if I were to die with him, I would never disown him. And Jesus walked deeper into the garden to pray alone. He asked us to keep watch and to pray. But we were so tired we could not stay awake. 3 times he woke us up, but we just could not stay awake. After the 3rd time, he told us that his betrayer was nearby. I could not believe it. It was Judas. Judas and armed temple guards marched towards Jesus. Judas called out, "Greetings, Rabbi." And he then kissed Jesus. I pulled out my sword and I cut off the ear of the high priest's servant. Jesus commanded us to stop. He stopped. He healed the man's ear and told us to put our weapons away because all who drew the sword would die by the sword. The guards took Jesus away while we scattered in fear of being arrested ourselves. Jesus was taken to the high priest's house. I followed at a distance, and it was cold, so I sat by the courtyard and by the fire while Jesus was inside being questioned. A servant came up to me and told everyone that I was with Jesus. I was scared to death, so I told her I didn't know what she was talking about. A little bit later, I started to go out the gateway. The moment another servant girl told everyone that I was a follower of that Jesus of Nazareth. This time, I even swore an oath, denying that I knew him. There were others standing near me and saying that I had to be one of his followers because I had a Galilean accent. I bragged that I would die before I would deny knowing Jesus. I had just denied knowing Jesus 3 times to save my own life. I was so filled with shame and self-hatred that all I could do was to run away bitterly, weeping. I cannot share with you what happened next.
Men who were guarding Jesus began mocking and beating him. They blindfolded him and demanded him, "Prophesy, who hit you?" And they said many other insulting things to him. At daybreak, the council of the elders of the people, both the chief priests and the teachers of the law, met together, and Jesus was led before them. "If you are the Messiah," they said, "tell us." Jesus answered, "If I tell you, you will not believe me. And if I ask you, you would not answer. But from now on, the Son of Man will be seated at the right hand of the mighty God." They all asked, "Are you the Son of God?" He replied, "You say that I am." Then they said, Why do we need any more testimony? We have heard it from his own lips." Then the whole assembly rose and led him off to Pilate. And they began to accuse him, saying, "We have found this man subverting our nation. He opposes payment of taxes to Caesar, claims to be Messiah, a king." So Pilate asked Jesus, "Are you the king of the Jews?" "You have said so," Jesus replied. Then Pilate announced to the chief priests of the crowd, "I find no basis for a charge against this man." But they insisted, "He stirs up the people all over Judea by his teaching. He started in Galilee and has come all the way here." On hearing this, Pilate asked if the man was a Galilean. When he learned that Jesus was under Herod's jurisdiction, he sent him to Herod, who was also in Jerusalem at the time. When Herod saw Jesus, he was greatly pleased, because for a long time he had been wanting to see him. From what he had heard about him, he hoped to see him perform a sign of some sort. He plied him many questions, but Jesus gave him no answers. The chief priests and the teachers of the law were standing there, vehemently accusing him. Then Herod and his soldiers ridiculed and mocked him. Dressing him in an elegant robe, they sent him back to Pilate. That day, Herod and Pilate became friends. Before this, they had been enemies. Pilate called together the chief priests, the rulers, and the people, and said to them, "You brought me this man as one who is inciting the people to rebellion. I have examined him in your presence and have found no basis for your charges against him. Neither has Herod, for he sent him back to us, and as you can see, he has done nothing to deserve death. Therefore, I will punish him and then release him. But the whole crowd shouted, "Away with this man, release Barabbas to us." Barabbas had been thrown into prison for an insurrection in the city and for murder. Wanting to release Jesus, Pilate appealed to them again, but they kept shouting, "Crucify him, crucify him." For the third time, he spoke to them, "Why? What crime has this man committed? I have found in him no grounds for the death penalty. Therefore, I will let him punish and then release him." But with the loud shouts, they insistently demanded that he be crucified, and their shouts prevailed. So Pilate decided to grant their demand. He released the man who had been thrown into prison for insurrection and murder, the one they asked for, and surrendered Jesus to their will. As the soldiers led him away, they seized Simon from Cyrene, who was on his way in from the country, and put the cross on him and made him carry it behind Jesus. A large number of people followed him, including women who mourned and wailed for him. Jesus turned and said to them, "Daughters of Jerusalem, do not weep for me. Weep for yourselves and for your children, for the time will come when you will say, 'Blessed are the childless women, the wombs that have never bore, and the breasts that have never nursed.' Then they will say to the mountains, 'Fall on us,' and to the hills, 'Cover us.' For if people do these things when the tree is green, what will happen when it is dry?" Two other men, both criminals, were also led out with him to be executed. When they came to the place called Skull, they crucified him there along with the criminals, one on his right and the other on his left. Jesus said, "Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they are doing." They divided up his clothes by casting lots. The people stood watching, and the rulers even sneered at him. They said, "He saved others. Let him save himself if he is God's Messiah, the chosen one." The soldiers also came up and mocked him. They offered him wine vinegar and said, "If you are the king of the Jews, save yourself." There was a written notice above him which read, "This is the king of the Jews." One of the criminals who hung there hurled insults at him, "Aren't you the Messiah? Save yourself and us." But the other criminal rebuked him. "Don't you fear God," he said, "since you are under the same sentence. We are punished justly, for we are getting what our deeds deserve. But this man has done nothing wrong." Then he said, "Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom." Jesus answered him, "Truly I tell you, today you will be with me in paradise." It was now about noon, and the darkness came over the whole land until 3 p.m, for the sun stopped shining, and the curtain of the temple was torn in two. Jesus called out with a loud voice, "Father, into your hands I commit my spirit." When he had said this, he breathed his last. The centurion, seeing what had happened, praised God and said, "Surely this was a righteous man."
It was over. I was in anguish as terror invaded my soul and my stomach and clenched it into a tight, painful knot. I struggled to believe that Jewish leaders were successful in having Jesus crucified. My world had collapsed. To know that by 9 a.m., soldiers were pounding nails into his hands and into his feet, and jerking him up on a cross to let him hang in the sun until the sun itself hid its face and left the onlookers to watch the master die in the eeriness of that very black night. I had fled. In fact, none of the 11 remaining disciples stayed to see Jesus buried. Only Mary Magdalene and a couple of the wealthy followers were left to take his body down, carry it outside the city, and entomb it. I was feeling despair. I walked around in a daze, utterly disoriented. I was shattered. The center of my world was now a deep black hole, an empty void. How could the Messiah, the heir of David's throne, be executed? It went against all logic. It was impossible. But it had happened. It had happened so swiftly. It appeared to be an almost normal Sabbath Saturday. If we had gone to Jesus' tomb at the crack of dawn, we would have seen nothing out of the ordinary. The body of the recently crucified man would have been on the slab in the tomb, bloodied, discolored, rigid with rigor mortis. It would have been a hideous sight if we could have seen it. It was behind a sealed boulder that covered the entrance. But in heaven above and on earth beneath, far from our human senses, there was enough activity to change eternity. Demons were raging. Satan had been stripped of all authority and power. Jesus, the Christ, had opened paradise. He had ushered in both the thief who had died beside him on the cross and all those who had believed in the coming Messiah through the ages. Matthew will later write, "At that moment, the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. The earth shook, the rocks split, and the tombs broke open. The bodies of many holy people who had died were raised to life. They came out of the tombs after Jesus' resurrection and went into the holy city and appeared to many people. The angels in heaven were rejoicing. God no longer had turned his back towards his son. There was a sense of a celebration was about to erupt at any moment. Still, back in Jerusalem, on the surface of the planet Earth, it appeared to be business as usual. If you'd stopped somebody on the streets of Jerusalem and asked them about the excitement of Friday's execution, they would have said, "It is Saturday, and it's finished." To them, then, like many of you in the 21st century, the fat lady had sung. The entire episode was history. It was history. Kaput, over with, through, concluded, and buried. There I was, over there by a wall, sobbing. I had denied my Lord. Three times I had denied my Lord. I could still hear the rooster crowing. I could still see Jesus turning his bloodied face towards me. He was looking at me. His eyes were locked on my eyes. As though he were saying, "I told you. I told you, but you would not listen." Still here, and the next day, I am convulsing with sobs of grief, but tears can no longer flow down my cheeks. I no longer have any tears to shed. I was cried out. The great rock upon which Jesus had said he would build his church was a has-been. I felt all washed up. Yes, it is Saturday, and it is finished, I thought. The rooster crowed again in the backyard of Caiaphas, the high priest. He was the same rooster I heard, the same rooster who rendered his shrill, lonely indictment. But the cock-a-doodle-doo of that rooster means something different to Caiaphas than it did to me. Finally, Caiaphas thought as he rose from his bed, finally, I've gotten rid of that charlatan. For 3 years, he's been a thorn in my side. For 1,000 days, I plotted and schemed to get rid of him. Oh, glorious Saturday, it is finished. And Caiaphas cast his eyes around the bedroom. Over in the corner were his torn priestly garments. Sure, it was against Levitical law to rip them, but it had been a nice theatrical touch. Maybe it had been the touch he needed to push the rest of the Sanhedrin into voting with him in favor of killing that messianic pretender. Caiaphas thought to himself, it is Saturday. and it is finished. Up there on the hill in the fortress, Pontius Pilate washed his hands for the umpteenth time. Since yesterday, his hands were chapped, red, rough from rubbing. They looked clean, but he muttered, "They feel so dirty." He asked himself, "What's on them?" They felt sticky. It felt like blood. But that could not be. That was ridiculous. Pilate's wife was still sleeping. Even though it was mid-morning on a Saturday, she usually did not sleep in, being an A-type personality. But she'd not been sleeping well. Lately, the past several nights had been troubling with terrible dreams and nightmares. In one strange vision, she saw the prisoner Pilate had condemned to death yesterday. She had gone to her husband, hysterically warning him not to have anything to do with that man. Now it was over. The guards had brought Pilate the news that the lunatic, the one who thought he was some kind of a king, the one who could not even defend himself before Pilate, had died, and rather quickly. Some of the Sanhedrin had come to him afterwards, asking for guards to be placed around the tomb so his body could not be stolen. "These Jews are such strange people," Pilate thought. "Why can I not put this thing to rest? Why can I not get the sticky stuff off my hands? After all, it's Saturday, and it is finished." And outside the city gates, someone out for a Sabbath walk discovered a hideous sight, a corpse dangling by its neck from an olive tree. Below the swinging, lifeless form lay 30 pieces of silver. Those who later investigated the death ruled it was a suicide. It was later discovered that the man's name was Judas Iscariot. What were his last thoughts as he tied the knot? No one will ever know. "Saturday, and it is finished," Judas. In a tiny house within the city walls, a woman cries. She had such high expectations for her son when he had been dedicated in that temple 33 years ago. An old man had warned her, "This child is destined for the fall and rising of many in Israel. He will cause you great pain. It will be as though a sword is piercing through your soul before it's all over." Now she knew what the old man meant. It felt as though a hot coal was burning in her belly. The hurt was greater than the pain of childbirth. She cried out the name of her departed son, "Jesus. Jesus. Jesus." She thought to herself, "Tomorrow I will go with the other women and anoint his body. He is still my son. Tomorrow is Sunday. It will be lawful to anoint his body then. But today is the Sabbath. It is Saturday, and it is finished." Meanwhile, Barabbas does not feel so bad after spending his first night of freedom following several years of being in prison. He reached out to touch his arm like a man who thinks he must be dreaming. He mutters to himself, "I must be the luckiest man in the world. Those fools, they crucified an innocent man. But who cares? I am still breathing." Barabbas got up, stumbled down the alley. He didn't care about the Jewish Sabbath. He'd long since stopped blindly obeying the Levitical laws. Those puny laws had been ineffective against the Roman dogs. All he knew was that the Romans had invaded his beloved Palestine and they had to be killed. He had killed once, and he would do it again soon. If an innocent man had to die yesterday so he could continue his mission of liberation, then so let it be. Yes, Barabbas thought, it is Saturday, and it is finished, especially for that man in the tomb. In a beautiful home a short distance outside Jerusalem in Bethany, three people, one man and two women, sat absorbed in their thoughts. The man reflected on the irony of it all. Here he, Lazarus, was well and whole. Jesus had raised him from the dead just a few weeks ago. And now Jesus is in the grave. And he, Lazarus, drinking his second cup of Saturday morning tea and eating a bagel. Martha, his sister, still sits for once. She's normally in virtual motion, but she's not cooking or cleaning or chattering today. She's thinking to herself, I will never fix him another meal. I will never wash his robe again. I will never be able to bring him another glass of cool water in my living room. I will never be able to ask him to tell my sister to help me in the kitchen. Martha's younger sister, Mary, sobs quietly. For some strange reason, the feature that keeps coming back to her is his feet. The last time she saw his feet, just yesterday afternoon, they had been grossly disfigured. Huge nails had been driven into them. They did not look like the feet that she had anointed just a few days before. They were not the feet at which she would sit, listening to his wonderful words of wisdom. This trio, Lazarus and Martha and Mary, captivated by their own thoughts, all thinking much the same thing. It is Saturday, and it is finished. Well, yes, it was Saturday. All those people, as well as I, although we are all different, did say it is finished yesterday afternoon. But was it really finished? Caiaphas, Pilate, Pilate's wife, Judas Iscariot, Mary, the mother of Jesus, Barabbas, Lazarus, Martha, Mary, and I thought so. I tossed and turned all Saturday night. As I pried my eyes open Sunday morning, the doom of death was heavy. I pulled my cloak around my eyes and hoping I could fall back to sleep again. Deep inside, I knew I could not. Suddenly, someone's banging at my door. Soldiers, they're coming for me, I thought. How can I escape? It was a female's voice. I recognized it as Mary Magdalene's voice. My terror encased me and turned to depression. Mary was breathless, troubled, her face stained with tears. I grumbled, "Why did you wake me so early?" And Mary blurted out, "They have taken the Lord out of the tomb." I turned to John and helped pull him to his feet. We slammed the door behind us and began to run through Jerusalem's narrow streets. We went out the city gates and continued towards the tomb. The great stone that had sealed the tomb had been rolled away. As we entered the tomb, it was empty, except for some folded grave clothes. The body was gone. Folded? That's strange. Folded grave clothes, but no body? Hardly what you would have expected from grave robbers. Even if Jesus had not died, but I knew he had. In his weakened condition, he could not have struggled out of those strips of cloth that had bound his body. No grave robber would have taken the time to unwrap them. I was baffled. John also saw the clothes and realized what they meant. He believed. My Easter faith would come a little later. Thursday night, when Jesus predicted that I would deny him, he also said, I have prayed for you that your faith will not fail you, and that when you come back, you will help the others. When you come back, when you come back, could that possibly mean that this terrible sense of isolation over the empty tomb would not last long? Because he lives, I can face tomorrow.